You are listening to John Diard's Life Spa, your premier source for health news and Ayurveda, where modern science meets ancient wisdom.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to LifeSpa.com, where Ayurveda meets modern science. And today's podcast, we have a special guest, a return guest, Yoga Rupa Rod Stryker. Super excited to have him talk about his new work on Yoga Nidra. We're going to dive into that. But before we do, let me tell you a little bit about Yoga Rupa Rod Stryker. He's a world-renowned yoga and meditation teacher, guiding and sharing his wisdom for 40 years. He's the founder of Para Yoga, the author of Four Desires, Creating a Life of Purpose, Happiness, Prosperity, and Freedom. He's the creator of one of the most comprehensive online yoga teacher training programs in the world, and recently has a very cool, he's going to talk to us about it, his new app called Sanctuary, which is a premier destination for all levels of those wanting to experience life-changing practices of meditation, Yoga Nidra, also known as enlightened sleep. That's Yoga Nidra, which we're going to talk about today, which is the ultimate silence of deep relaxation. So we're going to dive in. Rod, welcome back. Great to have you here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your latest foray into Yoga Nidra, which is, I'm also very fascinated about Yoga Nidra, and I can't wait to have this discussion and dive into the details.
Well, thank you for having me back. And last time was really a joy. We had a great conversation. You know, Yoga Nidra has been part of my background, Dr. John, for I was first exposed to it as many as three, almost four decades ago. My first teacher had been exposed to it in his travels in India. And so to give people, let's start with a kind of layman's understanding of what it might be, and then we can delve deeper and deeper into it. In essence, what it is the words Yoga Nidra mean effectively sleep with awareness. So Nidra means sleep. And yoga then means awareness. And effectively what this is referring to is a state that is similar, we could really describe it as the intersection of the height of meditation plus sleep. And there's lots to be said about it. It actually has, there's four stages of Yoga Nidra. In other words, you could lie down, practice relaxation, and start approaching the first stage. But the final stage is really considered to be the equivalent of enlightenment, where the mind is no longer confining you in any, no longer confining perception in any specific way. All of us kind of have a glimpse of it, even if we've never done it. And that is what I would suggest we kind of, the way to kind of access a sense of what it's like is in that those few seconds, maybe even less time than that, right before we fall asleep. So you and I and everyone else, we're in the world, we're in our waking state, we're possessed by all our responsibilities and concerns and goals and fears and all that stuff. And then somehow this miracle of sleep takes over, in which we kind of go into more or less a void. And Yoga Nidra speaks to what was that moment where you were moving out of waking consciousness and moving into that vast, limitless state of awareness or quietude that is sleep. And right in between, most of us will, if we think about it, you experience this kind of letting go, where really there is nothing holding you, confining your perception. And it's that state that we learn to kind of hover into. And ultimately now, there hasn't been a lot of clinical research in the West about it. But what we say is that it has it gives us the opportunity to access dreamless sleep, which is the technical term for that would be non-REM stage 3 sleep, which is when physiologically we do our most repair while we're sleeping. So that's just a little bit of a brief entry into what it is all about. In essence, it is the intersection of meditation and sleep.
Now, we know that there's different states of consciousness. There's waking, dreaming. There's states of higher level of consciousness, higher level of self-awareness. And, you know, I understand Yoga Nidra to be that technique where you obviously, you know, it's traditionally done lying down. And I'd love you to describe the process. of going into this deep, deep relaxation state. So you become more self-aware. And when you are in that self-awareness state, you sort of transcend thinking. You drop into that kind of quantum field of consciousness where we all come from. And in Ayurveda, the cause of disease is called the pragya prada, the mistake of the intellect, where the intellect starts to think it's something special, something different than that field. And isn't yoga nidra one of those techniques, like meditation, to kind of restore the smriti, the memory of pure consciousness? And then what are the potential healing effects of dipping the cloth in the dye of that consciousness on a regular basis?
Well, this is one of the reasons, that question is one of the reasons I love speaking with you. And because it, really, you've introduced some really critical ideas, and that take it out of just a pure physiological phenomenon, which yoga nidra, again, I touched on, is profoundly effective at, restorative and regenerative. But really, it's speaking to something quite profound, even sublime. And you've addressed it. So the teachings of yoga and Ayurveda, there's a huge amount of intersection and overlap. And indeed, what you began to describe is the three normative states that all human beings go through and that we're in at any given time: waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. And the way these seers and ancient sages began, what they revealed and what their experiences began, when they began to share their experiences, they proposed this. They proposed that in the same way that when we're in the dream state, effectively, most of the time, we experience it as real. In other words, when we're actually dreaming, whether we're running away from something or we're running towards something, or we're experiencing a certain fantasy being fulfilled or our greatest horror being fulfilled, we may wake up from the dream relieved or disappointed. And the fact is that our experience was that it was totally real while it was happening. Now we come out of the dream and we can objectify what was going on in the dream. Well, what they propose in their experiences, and yoga nidra points us toward, is the idea that in the waking state, most of the time we are dreaming. What they suggested, there was a Sanskrit term for this, which is turiya. They proposed, and turiya literally means the fourth. And they said there was a fourth state of consciousness, which was not confined the way dreams are, which is they appear real and then they're only no longer real to us when we've woken up. They suggested that in the waking state, we are in a bit of a dream. And it's only when we enter this fourth state that we can look back and the projection of good and bad, of personal and subjective awareness, is seen for what it is, a kind of dream. So you then propose something really interesting and really at the core of how yoga nidra can heal different scars in the fabric of how we perceive. In other words, over time we become conditioned, whether it's a relationship or a work or a view of ourselves, we view it through the prism of what? Our five senses and our memories and our learning. And so the proposition of yoga nidra is that by experiencing the vastness of consciousness, we now understand ourselves to be something other than our likes and dislikes and preferences and personal beliefs and things like that. So truly, it's a way of waking up. It's why I call yoga nidra, I call it enlightened sleep. It's actually a process of decompressing, in a sense, taking off the perceptions that we wear and that we live by in order to get a more vast view of ourselves and thereby see ourselves, see that part of us that is unchanging and unconfined. And from that perspective, we can begin to objectify even our own beliefs. You know, one of the things I say is we all can see the faults in people whom we're close to, or not even necessarily the faults, just the weaknesses in how they don't see themselves. So what this is suggesting is that when we tap into that field of limitless awareness, we can now begin to objectify ourselves. And as a result of collecting those experiences, use the word memory or smriti, we now begin to have a different and altogether different view of ourselves. And as a result, the feelings and the thoughts and our behavior begins to reflect us being able to objectify ourselves in light of the vastness of which we really are a part. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. I think it would be great if you could just, I mean, not obviously take us through Yoga Nidra, but take us through the steps to that you take people through to get down to that heightened state of awareness.
Well, you know, I should first acknowledge that there are a variety of systems being taught and now being popularized. When I began teaching Yoga Nidra about 30 years ago, very few people had even heard of it. And now it's one of the main features at almost all yoga studios in the United States as people are teaching Yoga Nidra. And we can talk about why in just a moment. I want to just address this idea that a lot of what is being practiced as Yoga Nidra is more geared toward the process rather than aiming toward the state that you and I have been talking about so far. In essence, the state is not so far away. It's like this proverbial fish swimming in water. The fact is that the state we're describing and the qualities of that awareness that we're describing, they're already here. We don't, in fact, have to create them. We don't have to recreate those states. All we have to do is relax our perception so that we experience it. So what that speaks to is really in the simplest processes of Yoga Nidra, it's really just a few steps. The first one is to step into a quality of non-doing. Now, that is easier said than done, but for instance, there are really steps where, one example of how I'd lead people in, and this is a kind of what I call the three essentials practice, which is essentially it would be to first become aware of the sounds in your environment. The more distant, the better. And then progressively become more aware of the sounds closer and closer to yourself. Normally, a huge amount of our attention is moving outward. So this is just that first step to begin to draw attention inward toward your own body. Next, you might become aware of the sensations and specifically where you're holding tension or restriction or contraction. And so for many of us, that might be the neck and the shoulders and the arms. We then ask people to very slowly just step into the intention to let go of the restriction, those sensations of tightness in your body. Once you do that, you've now drawn inward. You've begun the process of shifting from a sympathetic activation of the autonomic nervous system to a parasympathetic. In other words, the muscles are beginning to soften. And the next step will be that our breath will start to slow down. I then ask in that state for people to, so that's the first step. And then I should say it culminates in this idea that you're no longer holding yourself, but that you're being held. You're no longer the doing. You're actually experiencing the sense of the more you let go, the more you're supported. It's kind of, if anyone in your audience has done restorative yoga, where you're literally just dropping more and more into the floor is what really, in, I think, the practical experience of that is. And that's kind of a catchphrase I use consistently, which is the more you let go, the more you are supported. And that almost is antithetical to the way most of us live our lives. In other words, we feel like we have to do something in order to be okay. So now Yoga Nidra is really flipping that on its head. The second step then would to become aware of your breathing. And we can either give the cue to follow or to shape the breath for say 2 to 3 minutes with an emphasis on the breath being in the diaphragm, the lower abdomen. In other words, reducing the amount of the breath or the dominance of the breath in the chest, which is indicative of being in a sympathetic rhythm and kind of under the influence of stress. As you become more relaxed, your breathing will drop into the abdomen. And now maybe there's 2 to 3 minutes of just shaping the breath consciously down there, eventually then seeing the rhythm move involuntarily, and then giving some additional cues about how, as you relax, the rhythm will become slower and calmer and more shallow. And where that step culminates is I give the guidance or the direction that you are no longer the breather. You are the one aware of the body breathing. And while that, you know, I can describe it to you even in the sequence that we do it, but through a progression of very simple steps, we can lead people to have that experience that they are not the breather. They're the awareness of the body breathing. So we've already gotten maybe 2/3 into the basic process, and there are more. But then the final step is really to take them even further. In essence, invite them to put their body to sleep and their mind to sleep while they maintain that awareness of restful spaciousness. Now, because there's no effort in it, really the game is all about becoming increasingly effortless. Even the word relaxation is a tricky term. Very often people don't know how to relax. So it's not a word I use a lot. I actually describe the idea of directing or moving toward an increased state of effortlessness. So relaxation really means less effort.
Is sleep sort of a tricky word, you know, because we, you know, everybody thinks when they're asleep, but we're not really talking about sleep here. Can you help differentiate the sleep that you're talking about and the sleep that most people are familiar with?
Well, you know, sleep, in writing the book and researching for the book, you know, it's a remarkable process. And in fact, it's one of our maybe the most eloquent biological function that we have. REM sleep, that's the sleep we that's associated to dreaming, has it's kind of a miracle drug for us psychologically. It's when we start connecting life experiences, or we start reviewing, our brain actually goes into this process of reviewing memories and literally pruning away the memories that are no longer helpful and useful to us. It was actually now they noticed that of all the primates, we dream far more than any other primate. And the reason that the scientists say what that's all about is the fact that the complexity of human relationship and social structure necessitates us dreaming much more than any other animal, precisely because we have marriages and coworkers and political leaders and constantly relating to other people. When we go through a normal night's sleep, a lot of it is in and out of dreams, but that's actually not the sleep we're talking about. What you're referring to, Dr. John, is non-REM stage 3 sleep. And there's a term it's a relatively, I guess it's a scientific term, but it's homeostasis. And what this means is that your body is as close to being absolutely still as it will ever get. That is the main physiological repair of sleep. Now, we need to dream, as I've already said, but in terms of this, the real goal, the real elixir of sleep, physiologically speaking, is this non-REM stage 3 deep sleep. That's precisely what Yoga Nidra wants you to enter. The higher stages of Yoga Nidra are all about resting in complete stillness while you're fully aware. So, you know, the beauty of sleep is this, and whatever kind of sleep we're talking about. In part, the beauty of sleep is that we get a respite. We don't have to figure anything out. We don't have any responsibilities. We even forget what time it is. And hopefully, if we had a good night's sleep, it went by very fast and it really didn't feel like we expended 7 or 8 hours sleeping. That almost defines good sleep. So we enter into this kind of elegant abyss where really it's the domain of what these sages and seers of yoga and Ayurveda accessed in order to download all of this extraordinary information. In essence, that higher state of consciousness is present when we're sleeping, but since we're asleep, we're unconscious of it. So what we want to do is enter this rhythm of the deepest sleep, literally put the body to sleep, your mind to sleep, But this ever-present awareness that from the yoga perspective, we would call Purusha, that consciousness is still present. Your Purusha doesn't go to sleep. It's ever present. And so the sleep we're talking about is at a physiological level. It is deep sleep, dreamless sleep, but it's combined with the trace of awareness. And so that's this unique domain. Now, built into the actual methodology of Yoga Nidra are ways to address the value of dreaming. And so they insert different, consciously insert different images and dream-like conditions in order to facilitate the brain getting its hunger for what would be REM sleep. But the final stages are non-REM, and where we're in absolute stillness, but there's that trace of spacious awareness, the ever-present one who's always at rest, but always conscious, which is the soul.
So Yoga Nidra can be that technique, sort of like an alternate form of meditation, maybe a lot easier for folks who don't have great success meditating. Sometimes it's difficult to just turn this thing off. They drop into that state. They dip into that pool of pure awareness. Their body's completely at rest. Their mind is somewhat alert, but without thoughts. If I'm wrong here, stop me.
No, you're doing great.
In that state of heightened awareness while the body's at rest, their Yoga Nidra is also a very powerful, well-documented healing technique that can heal the body. So that's my next question is, does that healing take place just because you're into that field with your awareness? Or do you initiate a subtle thought, a sankalpa, a thought of healing at that point in time to elicit a desired healing effect if you're struggling with a problem? Or do we let it happen in an involuntary place?
Beautiful question, and coming from real understanding, actually both, Dr. John. The reality is, by accessing homeostasis, one thing I failed to mention earlier when I was speaking about sleep, and you were asking about the particular kind of sleep this is addressing, we only get about 20% of our time sleeping is spent in this state of homeostasis. So it's a relatively inefficient process. And lots of other stuff is going on, but in terms of the physiological repair, imagine over eight hours, we can do the math, it's about 100 minutes over 8 hours, maybe a little bit more, that you're actually in the deepest physiological repair. So what Yoga Nidra is aiming to do, and at least helps us approach, is a dominance of that during our time. This is why it's popular to say this. I'm not gonna go out on a limb and put it in the book until we have documented clinical studies about it. But what they say is that half an hour of Yoga Nidra is comparable to between 1 and 2 hours of sleep, of normative sleep. If you do the math, that can work out, but I'd like to see the research about it when the time comes. But for the time being, I can tell you anecdotally, it feels that way. What I often tell people is, if instead of sleeping for an extra 45 minutes, get out of bed, brush your teeth. There's 5 to 10 minutes of gentle gland stimulating exercises you can do. Really super simple. They don't require any flexibility. Anyone almost of any age, any capacity could do them. And then do Yoga Nidra for 20 minutes and you will actually feel more rested than if you stayed in bed for 45 minutes. As to your question about healing, so in part, it's just the fact you're doing it. You're laying down and you're approaching that rhythm of homeostasis. The second part, and one of the five aims of Yoga Nidra that allow us to tailor the practice depending on which one of those five aims we want to accomplish, is indeed specific imagery. And imagery is something that we use. My grand teacher, the teacher who taught my teacher about Yoga Nidra, who himself had really quite one, he did subject himself to clinical research. One of the first yogis to come to the US and actually in the Menninger Institute in Kansas, he was put under all of these tests, and one of which he wanted to prove that he was simultaneously could be conscious and asleep. So his EEGs, EKGs show deep sleep, but he asked that they have conversations around him, which essentially when we go to sleep, the prefrontal cerebral cortex, basically there's no more messages there. And when we're asleep, we're not hearing, we're hearing conversation, but we're not actually taking them in. But he was able, while clinically asleep, to recount completely the conversations that were happening and the content of that were happening around him. So he was demonstrating the fact you could be conscious and asleep at the same time, which in the 60s was just imagined, everyone imagined that to be impossible. I lost my train of thought here, but what he said, actually it was this, what he said was, and later in his life, he was actually diagnosed with cancer. He was told he would have 6 months to live. And 6 months later, the diagnosis failed to come, the prognosis didn't actually take place. He lived past that first prognosis. And he did that for almost 8 years. And one form of cancer would be cured, and then another form of cancer would show up 8 months later, and then that would go away. Turned out that he had some very important things to do, which was several humanitarian projects in India, including building hospitals and schools. When that was done, he stopped curing these cancers that were coming. And he said the secret to that healing, or the process involved in that, was visualization. And specifically what you addressed, which is as one is approaching, before one reaches the final stages of yoga nidra, and then again when you come out of yoga nidra, that you apply an image. And I will tell you that what he taught was that it's an image of our own making. It's not something I tell you about or impose on you, but rather through the introductory steps of yoga nidra, you reflect on your disease state and in a sense, allow an image to come forward of the disease state. And then you begin to go, then you move through these steps of relaxation. At least part of the way through those steps of relaxation, the image and the memory of the disease have completely faded. They now have completely dropped to the wayside. You now enter this rhythm of the deepest rest combined with awareness. And now upon moving out of that state, you go to the opposite. You, in a sense, create an intention to, for the image of the healing condition that you need, the antidote to what you previously saw, to arise. And so now you have your own healing image. And then in these last few moments of the yoga nidra practice, again, you've reached the height of the practice, and now it's in this dreamlike state where you're not in the depth of it, but you're moving out of it. Now you recreate the image in the deepest state of healing possible. And you rest in that image for a matter of minutes. And you're probably very familiar with the research about how this speeds up the healing process, and it triggers how imagery triggers healing processes throughout the body and shifts in our emotions as well. How we actually relate to our own disease state also changes. How we relate emotionally and intellectually around our own disease states.
Okay, so let me get this straight. And by the way, Rod has an app called the Sanctuary app where you can get guided to some yoga nidra practices. And of course, he has a book coming out called Enlightened Sleep Through Sounds True that's coming out in a bit. So, what you're saying is that you drop into that deep state of heightened awareness while the body's at rest. You have an image of the problem. You become naturally more self-aware of the problem. And one of the Vedic sayings that I love is you go to the pain or through the pain or through the problem, access a deeper unveil, like you said earlier on, the truth of you, the joy that awaits, the healing, the consciousness that awaits at a deeper level. And then when you go through the pain, the illness, you actually can recreate a new image, a healing image that actually then pervades like the petals of the flower opening and letting something more authentic, more deep, steeped in consciousness out that can actually in some way erase the memory of the cells that functioned from this lack of memory of proper function, lack of memory of functioning as part of the whole type state of function, and replace that sort of nationalistic, everybody functioning on their own, with a more globalistic, everybody functioning as one unit. And that's that kind of unified field consciousness-based infusion that takes place. But you have to first, what you're saying is, go through the pain and through the illness with imagery, and then you can naturally, spontaneously have an image of that healing place, and then you expand from there. Is that somewhat?
You see me smiling because I think you said it better than I did. But I will, I'd like to add on to a couple of things you mentioned. Indeed, good. You know, even if we have an injury that is not significantly debilitating or it's not a serious illness, there's invariably a contraction of some kind around it. There's right. a protection that occurs around it.
Right.
I see this in yoga so much, in yoga people's practice. You know, if they've had surgery, there's not just a physical scar. Invariably, there's a mental and emotional scar. If left untreated, if we don't bring awareness to it, invariably there's an unconscious holding that is the expression of that memory. And so that's point number one. I was asked very early on, one of the first times I taught this healing practice, where people had to, I asked people in the early stage of the practice to recognize the injury or the illness they were going to work on as an image. And afterwards, someone asked, is that really necessary? And I absolutely said it was, precisely so that we could bring a higher or expanded vision to the injury or the illness, such that we could begin to alleviate the unconsciousness around it and the scarring around it. And one of the ways I described that process, the whole of the process, the whole arc that you just described, is the idea of if we're trying to water a plant in which the soil has been dry for too long, the water can't be received by the roots. In other words, what we want to do is create a kind of porousness so that the intention and the power and our healing potential can actually seep down deep and create meaningful change. You are, you know, what I particularly liked in your description was this idea of reseeding a new memory, which the body and mind could both cohere to, that then began to facilitate change even at a cellular level. And that's indeed what this is about.
It's so beautiful. I mean, it's, you know, I learned it and understood it as something called Sankalpa. Patanjali talked about that, where you take that awareness down. And when you're in that field, you initiate thoughts, which at that most subtle place can have a very, very powerful effect. Matter of fact, I just literally finished writing an article on the ultra weak photon emissions that our human body, you know, emits. And these photons are rays of light that our body emits. And our skin has receptors for these photons. And they're now known to be carriers of information. And they're changed by intention. And when you self-observe yourself, you know from quantum physics that the observation of yourself changes the observed. It literally alters the structure or the information that these photons carry. And then they are transforming cells and DNA, according to now good science, and also emitted out of your body, and possibly the understanding of, you know, distance healing and a whole bunch of other stuff that can create some more of a quantum relationship that we have with one another versus a particulate relationship. But just taking that change of intention at that subtle level that the observer can change the observed in sort of any way it wants, depending on the intention, is a very powerful thing, which is now being well understood. And I think that's maybe one of the mechanisms why Yoga Nidra works. And I literally just was diving into this whole distance healing, self-healing thing, wrote an article about it, just finished it an hour ago. And I'm going like, dude, this is exactly what the mechanism for what's happening. There's science behind what you're saying. It's not just like drop into the consciousness, go into the field, dip the dye and the, you know, dip yourself in the cloth in the field. And then the dye, you know, you create a, you know, a more permanent effect. There's actually science that we're actually changing our, you know, our quantum particles, which then allow, like you said earlier, the, you know, the more of the who we are, the joy that we truly are inside, to feel safe enough to actually come out and do the healing and replace all the mental, emotional patterns of protection that we've armored up with. And that just started to get melted down. But I think what you said was so beautiful before is that it's truly this crazy mind of ours that creates this impact. And what you said earlier, I'm just going to recap for folks. You talked about pratyahara as the first thing we do. We use our senses to become more self-aware. Mm-hmm. And then once we have that self-awareness, we then feel and become more self-aware using sound. And then we start feeling the constrictions of your body. This is an old Ayurvedic technique called becoming aware of the marma points on your body, which are the junctions of consciousness and matter. When you become aware of those places, you create heightened awareness at that place. And then you become aware of your breath, you said. And the breath is that junction between the body and the mind, the anamaya kosha and the manomaya kosha. And the pranamaya kosha is in the middle. It's the mind-body connector. So then the breath starts to connect the mind and the body. And once you have the mind and the body and the prana connected, you're set, because now the body is naturally self-aware. All you got to do is drop into the Vijnanamaya Kosha and the Anandamaya Kosha, and you're now accessing the bliss. So it's a beautiful. We actually, I just finished filming a Ayurvedic psychology course with Yoga Journal. It's coming out in about a month, and we use the map of the koshas to drop from the body to the prana to the mind, and then drop into the bliss sheets, and then let them out using yoga breathing meditation, not yoga nidra, which is another. What you're saying is just so beautiful, particularly for the mind, because it is this crazy mind of ours that gets us into trouble. And we all need more tools to help us, of course, relax the body, but we're trying to, in a way, get the body out of the way so we can really access the root cause of all this.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that. I mean, so many wonderful points in what you just said. I mean, I do want to just point out for those who are listening, that Dr. John alluded to this idea of the observer. So when you begin to observe these things, but let's just to make it really clear, explicitly clear, this is not observing, say, your tension through the prism, through that lens of self-criticism that we're so accustomed to. It's not looking through the lens of our beliefs or our station in life and trying to judge and analyze what's there. Really what you're referring to, and it's one of my favorite definitions of this term Purusha, which is the term both for consciousness, but that what in our vernacular would be soul. So what I understood, the part, one of the etymological roots of that is Puru means city or vessel, and Sha means that which is at rest. So the Purusha is the one that's always at rest in your body. In other words, it's the thing that's always at home. And it of itself is this awareness. It is the power behind what you perceive. It is the power of perceiving itself. So one, it's always at rest, as you mentioned several times. Inherently, it is joy. And then and part two is it's inherently the seeing power. So that's a little bit more on the, let's say, cosmic side. But, you know, you've alluded to something a couple times, and I wanted to be certain that in our discussion about yoga nidra, it's not something that got left off. And you've begun to hint at it. So let's just say it. You know, the fact is I've taught meditation and practiced meditation for 40 years. But over the last 10 years, I think, and I think we have to look to the effect of technology, a huge amount of, the huge impact on our attention span on smartphones, significance of even what I understand now is looking into computer screens has an effect on the mitochondria and not just your vitality, but even the intelligence of the cells is being distorted by the amount of time we spend with indoor lighting and looking at our computer screens, plus the fact that so many of the apps that we use are inherently designed, are engineered to be sticky. And the way they're sticky, the way they keep us coming back for more, is they produce endorphins. And they elevate dopamine levels. And so now what's going on is that the reason we get stuck on Instagram or keep checking it all day is because each time we do, we get a shot of dopamine. And we get shots of dopamine that my understanding is they're multiples of the way we used to get dopamine. So in other words, just having a warm conversation, having dinner with loved ones, that produces dopamine. But nothing compared to Angry Birds, or nothing compared to leafing through Tinder or whatever those hookup kind of things are. They're inherently designed to produce dopamine, to elevate dopamine levels so that you continue to do it. The bottom line is they've had this effect on us being constantly distracted, constantly overstimulated, and by the way, very self-absorbed. Every Instagram post, people are aware of not so much what they're doing, but how it will reflect on their social media. And it's amazing to watch how people constantly step out of the moment in order to capture something that will mean more dopamine down the line for them. Now, the reason I'm saying all that is because I think the current state of affairs, there's always been monkey mind for thousands of years, for tens of thousands of years. People have not necessarily been perfect in their present moment awareness. They haven't necessarily perfected that. But I think we now live at a time where it's become, our minds are so scattered. And the reason I'm saying that is because more and more I believe that yoga nidra will be the way in to these meditative states, much more than meditation, precisely because of what you said right at the end of your share a moment ago, Dr. John, which was that it's the inability to focus or this monkey mind that makes meditation difficult. But beyond that is also the body. Like if you sit still for 3 to 5 minutes, chances are you'll start to experience those aches and pains. And it's hard to know what to do with them when you're sitting upright. The value of lying down and being absolutely comfortable so you can forget about your body, as you said, that's the goal. In essence, not to be stuck on the outside, but to go through these ever more refined layers in which we're able to approach a more accurate or true version of who we are, is made much more possible when we're comfortable. So between the level of distraction in the current age and the difficulty of moving past the body, it's for those reasons that I find yoga nidra may just be the entry point into these states of awareness that you and I have been describing since the beginning of our conversation today, much more than sitting meditation. It's not to say that they're absolutely the equivalent, but they're so closely related and so interrelated that I think if people get to glimpse that state of meditation through yoga nidra, that meditation will actually come more easily as a result.
Yeah, I think you make such a beautiful point. I think the old adage was, if you lie down and try to meditate, you're going to fall asleep, so you're just going to go to sleep. Right. But what yoga nidra provides is a way to lie down and actually not go to sleep, but to maintain that heightened awareness. And yeah. One of my favorite analogies that I've written a lot about and talk a lot about lately is the Dhanurved, the Veda of transformation, the Veda of the bow, where when you pull back the bow, if you are moving this thing around everywhere, who knows where the arrow is going to go. But if you pull back the bow and establish being, perfect silence, and then release the arrow from that place of silence, perform action from that place, which is, you know, yoga style Kuru Kamani. It's the whole point of the Bhagavad Gita, which is to take action from that place of stillness, is sort of what yoga nidra gets you to. It leaves your body, which is maybe broken down in the pain, alone, allows you to drop below it, heighten, you know, pull back the bow and get to that place where we can do the healing and create that inner relaxation, and then let that inner access of consciousness, peace and calm, do the healing. Where I think you're so right that meditation, you know, is challenging for a lot of folks. And, you know, when you ask people, like, yeah, I meditate, but how many people do it regularly? You don't get great numbers, because I think it's a challenge for us to slow down. And I couldn't agree with you more. I was talking to my kids. I still have six kids. I have still two in high school right now. And I was telling, I worked with Deepak Chopra for many years, and I quoted an old quote of his, which I said that he used to say that our inner space in between our cells is proportionally as void as intergalactic space. It's like a classic Deepak quote, right? Yeah. And I was like, you know, and I was just giving my kids that analogy, like, there's this incredible world of reward chemistry out there, but as proportionally as void as the stars is what's inside your cells. And don't you think we should take a look in there and not just only look out there? And, you know, and that's just what the Donner Veda, the Veda of transformation, not the Veda of war. Veda of transformation means we have to figure out a way to still the mind and then act from that place of deep silence. And I think that's what you're talking about. That's that Sankalpa, that Sankalpa piece, that where you can drop in and you can elicit a transformation of healing, and of course, you know, rejuvenation and revitalization and everything from yoga nidra without having the body being a barrier, which I think it is for a lot of folks.
There's a valuable piece of yoga nidra as well, and it's related to what you just described, which is that it's also a way to understand or to use the practice as a mirror. And by that, you know, the big challenge that we have, I often tell people that if you practice yoga nidra, the worst that will happen is you will fall deep asleep. Yeah. Because the steps are very progressive and they are relaxing, you'll find a quality of sleep that you don't normally get to, or you get to, as I said earlier, only about 20% of your sleep is that kind of sleep. The best that can happen is this promise of a higher state of awareness. But the reality is that, one, most of us are tired. You know, the statistics about sleep are alarming. The CDC has actually declared that its lack of sufficient rest is actually a national, even a global health crisis. And it's, we could have a whole conversation around the pathologies that accompany this lack of sufficient sleep, 7 to 9 hours in an adult, et cetera. But the good news is it doesn't have to be in a row. Human beings are actually biphasic, meaning that a half hour nap in the middle of the day is actually quite good for you. And your circadian rhythm is actually, that's built in, is that you would take that. But what I was going to say is the big challenge people have is staying awake and getting to this higher consciousness piece. The good news is you'll fall asleep and you'll get some of the rest you need. Bad news is you don't get quite the level of awakening that we've been describing. And then people often ask me, well, why can't I stay awake? And I said, you know, at a very practical level, it's because you're tired. But if you would start to practice it 3 to 4 days, 5 days a week for 20 minutes, 25 minutes, lo and behold, you'll start providing some of the rest your system needs, and over a period of time, it's easier to stay awake. But there is a deeper reason why we fall asleep. And the deeper reason is that very often we consciously or unconsciously avoid present moment awareness. As human beings, we drift right back into habitual thinking and behavior. And there's an instant before, I don't know whether you're picking up a cigarette or you're drinking another cup of coffee or you're going to Instagram one too many times that day or you're checking your emails. There is a moment of choice that we make. And the choice, in essence, for whatever reason, whatever that temporary gratification we get from those habits and whatever the cost benefit we're willing to expend in order to maintain that negative habit, there is a moment of choice. And that choice is one way to describe it is, you know, and I thought of that as you were pulling the arrow and the arrow had to be, and the bow had to be still, which is a way of turning away from our awakening of our greatest potential. For whatever reason that is, whether it's parents' voices or psychological or astrological or emotional or psychic, we step away from being fully present. And the more we do that, you talked about memory in the very beginning of our conversation, the more we have a memory of stepping out of that optimal choice or out of that discernment, now what happens, it gets carried over to yoga nidra. Because that, from the yogic perspective, that's a kind of going to sleep. Right. What happens is you're well practiced at that and you lie down, chances are you'll choose sleep and not hovering in that heightened awareness because there's so much memory of having done it. So in that way, yoga nidra actually becomes a mirror in which we can now begin to become more conscious of that moment where we turn off attention and we turn into habituation. We turn back to habituation. And very often, if your body has gotten rested through some repetition of the practice, that's the only step that you need to address in order to stay awake for the entire practice, is how often do I go to sleep in my life? That's going to be a reflection of how often I go to sleep in yoga nidra.
I love it. I think you're so right on that. People are so habituated and they're so locked into those repetitive patterns of behavior that they don't have the awareness of door number two. They just have awareness of door number one. And they just keep going down door number one, door number one, door number one. But with this practice of self-awareness, yoga nidra, you begin to realize there's door number two and I never saw it. It was always right there. And You can, at some point, getting clobbered in door number one enough times, you'll experiment with taking a choice and having that choice to become more self-aware, and as opposed to doing that instant gratification reward chemistry thing is just a beautiful, beautiful sentiment. It reminds me of two of my very favorite sayings in Ayurveda. One is to do less and accomplish more, and which is what we practice in Ayurveda, is, trying to get with the rhythms and, make life a little easier for yourself. Definitely happens with technology. We get to do less and accomplish more. Mm-hmm. But the ultimate goal of Vedic science is to do nothing and accomplish everything. And that is what you're describing. When you drop into that place where you're fully at rest, but fully alert at the same time, that's invincibility. That's what the whole Donner Vade warrior, spiritual warrior thing was. No one could ever take you out because you're deeply rested. Even while sleeping, you're fully awake. So nothing could surprise you. You're invincible from fire or harm in every way because you are the eye of the storm. You're the eye, the calm, and you're the winds that are powerful, but you're coexisting these opposite experiences and you're living them in every day of your life. So you take that yoga nidra with you into your life. It's not just something you do on the floor. You take it with you, right? That's the whole point. And you walk it. I think I read some studies that show that the brainwave patterns of yoga nidra includes boosted alpha, boosted theta, and boosted gamma. And gamma is a very high conscious state, which actually lingers and can stay with you, carrying that conscious awareness with you into your life. I love your comment on that. I'm sure you know a lot more about that than I do.
Well, the thing I was asked recently, it reminds me, I was asked recently, I did a podcast a couple months back and by a student of mine who's actually a great interviewer and really smart. And she asked me to kind of reduce it down. She says, so why does it work so well? I mean, one of the things that in commenting on what you just said, Dr. John, is the idea that even if you do, what we're doing is we're really approaching this innate state of joy. That some of the yogic texts actually say that the state of happiness that we experience in life is actually a glimpse of the innate joy that is us, right? So while we're starting to relax, even if we don't make it to the end, we're starting to experience that joy, which now we have a way of objectifying our normal life experience. But this woman asked me, she said, so why does it work so well? And looking back, even as I was answering her question, I realized I was giving too technical an answer. But I went on and on and on. And then, I think she was satisfied with my answer. I got home and I thought, you've got to find a better answer. You've got to find something that really speaks to, that really is efficient and speaks to the heart of it. And here's it in a nutshell and addresses what I think you, in a way, encapsulates what you just said. I think everything about modern life is we can look at two things are happening. One is acceleration. Everything gets faster and faster. Every iteration of my phone or my computer or my camera or everything is about speed. You know, so things are getting faster and faster. And we could make the case that we're beginning to even outpace our body's ability to assimilate and digest, as well as our mind's ability to assimilate and digest everything that we're taking in. Number two, there's greater segmentation or division in all of this acceleration. In other words, more and more information, but they're divided and they're bit-like. What I would say yoga nidra is all about, and what stimulated was your mentioning of the gamma wave in the brain. There's no coherence. Without something like yoga nidra or meditation or deep reflective prayer, without time and silence in nature, there's a relatively short list of things that we can do where we create coherence, where our body begins to return to its own biological, let's say, optimal functioning, and coherence where there's a unification going on, where, let's say, all of the tissues with their various roles begin to interact with what are they serving? What's the intelligence that they're all in the service of? My heart, my liver, the function of my red blood cells, my brain cells, my T cells, all of these cells, what are they in function of? What are they actually trying to support? Well, yoga nidra is what is in essence answering that question. It's in support of Purusha. It's in support of consciousness. And now it becomes a feedback loop where as we begin to return to consciousness, consciousness begins to inform all of the diversity that is both within our body and the world that we're interacting with. It's still a long answer to her question, but in essence, yoga nidra is shifting us from acceleration to slowing down and from dispersing of our energy to recollecting energy and unifying that energy. And that, again, those are big words. The bottom line is it feels fantastic. When you do that, you really feel like you're back home again. And I think that's what the staying power of the practice is. And what people quickly begin to, when they experience it, they're quickly drawn to repeat it and to share it with their friends and their family, because there's obviously a lot of division within ourselves, a lot of conflict in the world we live in. And it's hard to find a unifying principle. And of course, the ultimate unifying principle is our awareness, is consciousness itself and our own soul, spirit. So by approaching that, then yoga nidra or that experience begins to reunify and bring greater functionality, optimal wellness at the level of the body and the mind and our souls.
No, it's so beautiful and so needed. I'm so glad we're talking about this and that you're bringing this out and people can get guided to to yoga nidra right now just by downloading your app, right? Sanctuary app, right?
Exactly right. There's free content there, and then there's a subscription model where every month there's five new practices, meditations, as well as a new yoga nidra practice every month. And again, the beauty of it, we've said it, but it bears repeating. The nice thing is you really just get to lie down, be comfortable, ensure that you'll be warm, and then you're guided very systematically through steps that your task, if we can call it that, is to become more effortless. So it's something that's accessible. My mom right now is in the hospital. She broke her hip on her 86th birthday, unfortunately. And it's something she's begun to do in her hospital bed. So it literally is anything anyone can do and start right off to experience the kind of value that and benefits that we're talking about.
I'll send her some photons.
Okay.
And in closing, you mentioned, I don't know if you could do this briefly, but I think it'd be a great recap. You mentioned the five aims, sort of briefly. Sure. If you could just list those five aims and then I'll let you go and get everybody to your app and we'll go from there, okay?
Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to do that. So general healing, physiologically, mentally, emotionally, that goes that actually is something that you and I touched upon. Yeah. There's also the improvement of cognition, cognitive powers, which reflect on memory and also our ability to process. So we improve memory, but also our ability to process emotions and experiences of the past so that we can more completely show up and be clear in the moment. So there's the cognitive element to the practice. You've mentioned this word several times, sankalpa, specifically to build sankalpa. And there's a very specific science articulated by my teachers and our tradition around how that's done. And it's how we build sankalpa. And let's just put it this way, through this process of getting deeply relaxed, ultimately entering into, and I'm using my words carefully, entering into a state of doubtlessness. This is actually a word taken directly out of the scriptures. So therefore, when you want to accomplish something, if it's accompanied by any measure of doubt, it's said to be an imperfect sankalpa. What we first need to do is relax to the point or to the degree that we entered what we could call unified awareness, where doubt cannot enter because doubt is based in duality. And from there, seed sankalpa. Sankalpa, healing. Then there's a process for specific healing that we already addressed in our conversation. And or transformation. So this fourth area is kind of an area of deep healing or transformation. Transformation relates to transforming old beliefs. So this would be at the level of the Vijnanamaya Kosha. You mentioned the koshas before. This is at the deep intellect, level of the deep intellect, where we hold our deep-seated programming and beliefs, or specific healing. And then the final one is really yoga nidra as a spiritual practice, purely a way of awakening to that sense of who we are that ultimately is indescribable. Ultimately, we can't find the words to describe that. But one way of suggesting pointing to it is it's that part of you that has no beginning or end, that's always new and yet never changing. Wow. So that's the five. And again, I'll say that what I learned, our approach is such that depending on which one of those five we want to emphasize, the practice would change. So the actual template and steps change depending if we go from general healing all the way to spirituality. They change. There's overlap, but the practice can change.
Sure.
So for obviously, example, if go to my app, if people go there, they'll find there's four sections. A peace section, a heal section, an empower section, and a spirit section. And that's a way of dividing these five different aims of yoga nidra.
Beautiful. I will definitely download the app. Thank you so much, Rod. What a beautiful work. I mean, this is something that it's a lifelong practice. It's a practice that'll take you all the way, you know, which is pretty special and super easy, right? I mean, it's the simplest thing in the world, right?
It is. It is. It's just, again, the worst that's going to happen is you're going to fall asleep. The best that's going to happen is you're going to meet your maker. You're going to rest in your spirit.
Not a bad deal. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming and joining us today. And we'll see you next time. Thanks so much.
That's your pleasure, Dr. John. Thank you so much.
Take care.